The following is a sermon by Pastor Todd Dykstra, teaching pastor of Maranatha Bible Church of Comstock Park, Michigan. For more information, go to mbcmi.org.
All right, well, would you open your Bibles to Matthew 24? We're back at Matthew 24 after a couple weeks off for Christmas, and we return this morning to our study of the Olivet Discourse. Matthew 24 and 25, these two chapters, of course, which contain probably the greatest description by Christ anywhere on the end times. So we have been working our way through this. We've been at it for a number of weeks now, looking at what Jesus wants us to know about eschatology. We have said in the first few verses, verses 4 to 14, Christ has described the events leading up to the midpoint of the tribulation. Then verses 15 to 28 describe the events from the midpoint of the tribulation to almost the arrival of Christ. And then verses 29 to 31 describe his arrival. Let me read those verses again, verses 29 to 31. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory, and he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. We said when we walked through that passage that Christ's return will be obvious and it will be undeniable and it will be awesome in its displays of power that he comes with. And so we have looked at all of this information, these first 31 verses of Matthew 24, and we have studied what are some of the specific details associated with the end times. The question we need to ask is, what do we do with all this information? Or maybe a better way of just saying it is, so what? What are the implications? What do we do with all of this? What does this mean practically? On the one hand, we've understood the rapture. We have understood the tribulation. We have talked about the judgment seat of Christ and the marriage of the Lamb. And we have talked about Christ's return. In fact, a couple weeks ago, we looked at the specific events that are going to take place when Jesus returns. He's going to judge the nations and destroy the wicked and bind the devil and raise the martyrs and save the Jews and establish his kingdom. We know all of this. We've studied this. We have looked at charts and diagrams, and we've put slides on the screen so we have an understanding of how these end times events are going to take place. But the question we want to ask is, so what? What does this mean for our lives? What is this meant to impact us? How is this meant to impact us? What are the implications? How then are we to live? You probably know that good preaching, good teaching always weaves into the sermons or the lectures or the instruction elements of application and implications. Preaching is not just a data dump. It's not just giving information. It involves exhorting. It involves imploring. It involves pleading. It involves ways that our lives need to change, calls to response and ramifications and implications and ways our hearts need to respond to these truths that we're hearing. This is what good preaching does. It engages the heart. It engages the soul. It instructs us how we need to think differently and live differently. And Jesus is like that. Jesus is the consummate preacher. He's the consummate teacher. He knows this. And so after 31 verses of specific details about the end times and how it's going to happen and the signs and the things that we should be expecting, Jesus turns the corner starting in verse 32 with application, implications, ramifications. He brings it home to us. He begins implicating our hearts. He begins showing how a right understanding of eschatology is meant to impact us. In fact, from verse 32 of Matthew 24 to nearly the end of Matthew 25, there are six parables meant to implicate us, meant to teach us what a right understanding of the end times means for us and how we are to live. We're going to this morning look at the first parable in verses 32 to 35, and then there's another one in verses 36 to 41 about Noah's day, and then there'll be the parable of the faithful householder in verses 42 to 44, and then there's the parable of the wise servant in Matthew 24, 45. 45 to 51, and then in chapter 25, the parable of the 10 virgins, the first 13 verses of that chapter, and then starting in Matthew 25, verse 14, the parable of the talents. Jesus gives one parable right after the other to implicate our hearts. By the way, I would suggest to you that an understanding of eschatology is not just for our minds. It is not just to understand charts and diagrams. It is not just to have our eschatology all worked out. I would argue that a right understanding of the end times is to inform how we live today. There are a number of ways that our lives need to be lived in light of the things that we know about the end times. We should be urgent in our pursuit of holiness. Knowing that the end is coming, we should persevere in the face of affliction, knowing what is coming. We should be zealous in our devotion to discipleship as we understand what is on the way. We should be faithful in our service to God and diligent in our ministry to others and steadfast in our work of the Lord, knowing that He's coming again. All of these are ways that our lives need to be lived in light of the fact that Jesus is coming back. And so starting this morning, for the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at some of these applications. Ways that our lives need to change. Ways that our lives need to be lived in light of these glorious realities. And I would just summarize what we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks by saying this, that we need to be alert and prepared and steadfast. We need to be watchful. We need to be serving the Lord in anticipation of His coming. All of these things are marks of those who have their eyes set on the fact that Jesus is coming back. Now, let me just say, as we dive into this, I believe that the primary application of these parables will be for those who are living in those days. In other words, the primary audience that Jesus has in view here will be that generation that is living when these events are actually taking place, when the tribulation signs are there, when all of these details are actually coming to fruition. I believe that the primary application of this passage is for those who will be experiencing those realities. We're not in those realities yet. The tribulation is not here. The abomination of desolation has not happened. We're not presently living in the days that Jesus has described here in Matthew 24. Although there are birth pangs and we know what is coming and we see these details being laid out, we're not actually in the end times yet. We're in the last days, but we're not in the actual times that Jesus has described here. So the primary application to these verses, these chapters, I believe, are the people who will be living in those days. They will need to pay attention. Specifically, they will need to be alert. They will need to be attentive. They will need to be reading their times so that they are watchful and diligent looking at all that is taking place so that they can obey Christ in the midst of those times. However, having said that, there are timeless principles for us even here today. So I believe there are secondary applications in these parables for us that we likewise need to be watchful. We need to be prepared. We need to be faithful believers, living alert, discerning lives, knowing the days that we are living in. There needs to be an awareness with us, about us, that comes with remembering these words and what Jesus is teaching us. In other words, these truths still have implications for us today. Jesus is on his way back. And we believe the first phase of that will be the rapture of the church. By the way, remember we've said that there are distinctions between the rapture and the second coming. They are two phases of the same event, but they are different in their phases. The rapture is not the second coming. There are distinctions there. In the rapture, Jesus comes for us. In the second coming, he comes with us. In the rapture, he comes and he meets us in the clouds. In the second coming, he comes all the way to earth. In the rapture, he resurrects believers from the church age. In the second coming, he raptures or resurrects those from the Old Testament and those in the tribulation who were martyred. There are distinctions between these. We believe that they're not the same event, that the distinctions exist between the rapture and the second coming, 7 years between those two events, two phases of the coming of Christ. We believe, though, that as believers, we need to be watchful. The next event on the eschatological timeline, we believe, is the rapture. And do you think about that? Do you realize that any moment Christ could return for you as a believer? And does that matter how you live today? Does that make a difference in how you think? Does it make a difference in how you act? Does it make a difference in how you invest your time and your money and your resources? Are you watchful? Are you vigilant? Are you attentive? That's what these parables teach us. So this morning, we want to come to the first one. Verses 32 to 35 is the parable of the fig tree, and we want to spend our time this morning looking at these four verses. Follow along as I read them. Now, learn the parable from the fig tree when its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves. You know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Here's the first parable Jesus tells to drive home the implications of how we need to live in light of his coming. And so we want to look at this morning. We want to think about whether we're living prepared, thoughtful, discerning, vigilant lives. And to help us with that, I want to give you 3 points this morning. And we'll just look at them as we come to them. First, number one is the analogy that Christ gives. We're just going to walk through this text together. First point is the analogy that Christ gives. Look at verse 32. Here's the analogy. Now, learn the parable from the fig tree when its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves. You know that summer is near. Notice the first words Jesus says in this verse. He says, now learn the parable from the fig tree. This is a command. You need to learn the lesson here. This is not something you can just kind of think about and say, that's interesting. No, there's a lesson here for us, and we need to learn this. Christ is commanding, he's exhorting us, learn something specific from this parable that I'm about to tell you. It's been a while since we've been in parables, so Let me just remind you of a few things. Remember back in Matthew 13, the whole chapter is parables. And so we spend some time talking about parables. Let me just remind you what a parable is. The word parable is the word parabole, which actually comes from two words, para and balo, which means to throw alongside. Para means to come alongside. Balo means to throw. So the word literally means to throw beside, to put something beside, to cast aside. That's what a parable is. A parable is an earthly story put next to spiritual realities to teach us something. Some have qualified a parable as an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. It's a good way to put it. It's a story, it's an illustration, an expanded illustration taken from something that we would know in this life, something that we're all familiar with. Jesus does this so many times. He takes something from nature, from our world, from the way that we live in this life, and he applies it, or he tells a story about it and lays it alongside spiritual realities to make them become clear and evident. It's a brilliant teaching method. One writer has described it this way: a parable is a true-to-life story to illustrate or illuminate a truth. It is true to life, though it may not have actually occurred in all the details as the story presented. Parables are special stories, not necessarily historic events, that are told to teach a particular truth. That's what a parable is. It's something taken from life, something we're all familiar with. It's so common that we all are aware of it, and Jesus takes it and lays it alongside a spiritual truth. Now, usually there's one point to a parable. This is where sometimes people go off. They try to assign meanings to all the little nuances in parables, and they make parables say something they were never intended to say. Usually a parable has one meaning, one primary thrust. Another writer has described a parable as an appeal from what people know in the realm of ordinary life to truth Jesus wants to teach in the spiritual life. It's taking something from our world, laying it alongside of a spiritual reality to teach an important spiritual truth. These are what parables are. And you remember back in chapter 13, we said there are two purposes of parables: to conceal and to reveal. You want to know why Jesus teaches in parables? Those are the two reasons. He teaches in parables to conceal truth and to reveal truth. So there are times Jesus wants to conceal truth from certain people, certain crowds, certain groups, particularly in chapter 13, once the people had rejected him, he turns to parables, so that when they're not explained, they're not understood. They're enigmatic. They conceal truth from those that Jesus wants to conceal truth from. It's a form of judgment on them. So in some cases, Jesus tells parables to conceal truth. And in other cases, he tells parables to reveal truth, to explain realities and elucidate the meaning that he is intending. That's exactly what's happening here. He's speaking to his disciples. He wants them to understand these realities, so he tells a parable and then explains the parable so that they understand these things with greater clarity and greater conviction. So why do you have parables in the New Testament? To conceal truth from those that Jesus does not want to reveal it to, as a form of judgment by not explaining the meaning, and to reveal truth to those that he wants to give greater clarification and elucidation to. So here in Matthew 24, we have many parables once again. And the first one he tells here is that of a fig tree. Verse 32, "Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near." Most of us are not familiar with fig trees. We have oaks, we have maples, we have evergreens around here. In that day, they would have been very familiar with fig trees. They dotted the landscape. They were all over Palestine. They symbolized life. They often symbolized Israel. And in this case, Jesus is using the fig tree as an analogy. Now, here's something just to help you comprehend what Jesus is getting at. Fig trees were almost the only tree in Israel that lost their leaves in the winter. Most of the trees were evergreens. They did not lose their leaves. There was one other tree, the almond tree, that did lose its leaves in the winter, but those leaves would come back in early spring, not the fig tree. The fig tree would lose its leaves for the winter, and they wouldn't grow back until late spring, until it's almost summertime. And that's exactly why Jesus is using this tree in his parable. He says, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. It's a sign, it's a symbol, it's an indicator. When you begin to see fig trees budding out and leaves forming, you know that summer is not far away. When the sap starts flowing back into the tree, when those leaves start to come out in the very first glimpse, then you know summer's close. It's on its way, it's near. The appearance of these new shoots in the spring are signs that summer is coming close. We get this, don't we? We Michiganders, we get this. We don't have fig trees, but we get the same kind of thing, right? We see all these trees in the fall that are beautiful, and they have all these beautiful colors, and then everything's gone. All the leaves are gone. There's this stark beauty, there's still some evergreens, and we endure these long winters in Michigan. We're in them right now. We're in the dark ages. And we're all counting the days until spring comes, right? We're 84 days away or something like that from spring being here. And so we're looking for the snow melting, the days getting longer, the trees starting to bud out and leaves start to form in April. When all of that starts to happen, what do we say? Spring is here and summer's on its way. Exactly what Jesus is talking about here. It's the same kind of analogy. It happens every single year, season after season, year after year. The trees go through this cycle. They lose their leaves in the winter. They bud out in the spring. All of that is an indicator that spring has come and summer is close. Pretty straightforward. Pretty easy to understand. That's the analogy. Number two is the meaning Christ intends. What is meant by this? Why is it necessary for us to comprehend this analogy? Why is he using this analogy to communicate things related to the end times? Well, that's where he goes next. He's told the parable. He's told the story. He has used something from common life, a fig tree, something they were all familiar with. Now he's going to begin to draw the lessons to implicate our hearts. He's beginning to tell us now the meaning of this parable, and it comes in verse 33. He says, so you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Here's the purpose. Here's the reason he's telling this little story, is because he wants us to know that the signs that he's just been describing in the first 31 verses of this chapter, those signs, when you begin to see those taking place, again, remember the primary audience, primary audience, those living when these signs are actually occurring. When you see those signs taking place, when you see the birth pangs listed in verses 4 to 14, when you see the abomination taking place described in verse 15, when you see the need to flee to the hills and don't grab your cloak and run away as described in verses 16 to 28, when you see the upheaval in the universe, verse 29, and the sun goes dark and the moon doesn't give its light anymore and the stars start to fall from the sky, when you start to see these signs, when you're living in this time period and you witness these things, Christ is almost here. Just like you see the buds on the fig tree coming in late spring, just like you see the leaves forming after the winter, you know that spring has arrived and summer is on the way. In the same way, Jesus says, just like that, when you see these signs, when you witness these harbingers of the coming of Christ, you need to know that it's close. It's imminent. He's very near. You remember what Jesus is doing? He's answering questions. Go back to verse 3 of this chapter and remember the questions that were asked of him. Actually, verse 2, remember the disciples came up to him and they said to him, verse 2, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, well, this is him responding to them, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down. They want to know all that's going on. They're wanting to know when this is going to take place. And so this is when they ask in verse 3, the disciples came to him saying, tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? These are the questions on their mind. Tell us, Jesus, how will we know that this is happening? What will the signs be? And number 2, when is it going to take place? They had two questions, a what question and a when question. They want to know how they will begin to detect these end times events. They want to know when it's about to get close. They want to know when he's returning. And so they ask him the first question, when, verse 3, and then the second question, what will your signs be? And Jesus answers those two questions in reverse order. First question is a when question. Second question is a what question. He takes the what question first, and he begins answering the what question with the signs. And for the last few verses that we've been looking at, all the way to verse 31, he's been describing the signs. Next week when you come, we'll start looking at the when question. He's still describing here the what question, the signs. How do you know when he's near? You're going to see all of these signs. You're going to be aware that these things are happening. You're going to see these things that I predicted taking place. Now listen. Primary application to that audience is this. When you see them, I'm close. So be on the alert, be watching, be vigilant, so that you can do what I've told you to do, so that you can obey me. This is his point. This is why he wants them to be alert, because he's commanded them to do certain things. Like what? Look, go up to verse 16. What does he command them to do when these signs happen? Verse 16 says you need to flee to the mountains. So they need to be listening, they need to be attentive, they need to be alert, so that when they see these signs, they can run for the hills. Verse 17, notice what he says, don't go down and get your things out of your house. Verse 18, don't turn back to get your cloak. Verse 20, pray your flight will not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. Skip down to verse 25, what does he tell them to do? I've told you in advance, if they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go out, or behold, he's in the wilderness, or in the inner rooms, do not believe them, for just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so will the coming of the Son be. Notice what he's saying. There's things that you're going to have to do. You're going to have to run for the hills. You're going to have to not grab your cloak. You're going to not go back to your house. You're not going to pay attention to these false teachers. in order to obey Christ, in these days, you must be alert. You must be watchful. You must be vigilant. You must pay attention so that when this time comes, you can obey him as he's instructed you to obey him. Or to say it another way, they will need to pay attention to the signs Jesus predicts so that they can obey the instructions that Jesus gives. You understand the principle? You have to be alert. You have to be attentive. You have to be watchful and paying attention to what's going on in your world and in society and in the things around us, because if you're not attentive, if you're spiritually lazy, you might miss the things that God would want you to pay attention to, and in doing so, you might miss what you need to know to obey him. That's the timeless principle. Primary application for those living when these signs are taking place. Secondary application for us today, that we need to also be watchful people. We need to be those who are not given to spiritual slumber, spiritual laziness, spiritual drowsiness. Because if we fall into that, if we fall prey to these types of realities, we're going to then be not as alert. And when we're not as alert, we're not as obedient. So can I ask you, have you lost your spiritual edge? Have you become spiritually drowsy? Are you spiritually lazy? It's been a good year. Stocks are up, got a good job, can coast. I think we all need to be honest and admit sometimes we fall into spiritual laziness. Sometimes we're not as sharp spiritually as we once were. Sometimes we get a little spiritually apathetic. We're not in the Word like we should be. We're not praying like we should be. We're cutting corners spiritually. Little things that we would not do previously in our Christian life, we start to do, we start to compromise, we start to slack spiritually, we start to cut the corner spiritually. We justify sin, our love for Christ starts to fade, our longing for heaven is a faint memory, church is not that important anymore, the things of the Lord fall less and less on the priority scale, we get a little lethargic, we're not interested in spiritual things like we once were, the things of the world become a little more attractive, money, possessions, entertainment, vacations, these things become more predominant in our affections. We lose sight of spiritual realities. We're not as sharp as we once were because the world is starting to creep into our hearts, so our spiritual radar is not as attuned. Our spiritual antenna are not up. We get lethargic. We get lazy. We start to be less concerned about spiritual things and more interested in the things of this world. That's never good. That is never good. It's always a dangerous place to be. It's always a dangerous place to be, because when you find yourself in that place, there's a danger for spiritual erosion. And it's subtle, and it's slow, and sometimes it's often imperceptible. But eventually, after time, after days, after weeks, after years, after months, we start to find ourselves in a position where that spiritual edge is gone. Let me show an example. Go over to Romans 13. Just turn a little bit to the right. Romans chapter 13, Paul actually picks up on this very reality. Romans chapter 13, he talks about the danger of spiritual slumber, the danger of spiritual laziness and lethargy. Romans chapter 13, look at verse 11. He says, "Do this, knowing the time, that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep." First of all, notice the instruction. Do you know the times? Do you know the days you're living in? Are you aware of the age in which we are currently living? We are living in the last days. Not the end times. We're not in the end times events yet, but we're in the last days. Do you know what this day is like? Do you understand the age? Do you understand the principles of this age? Do you know what you're up against in this world? Do you know your times that you're living in? Notice what he says. Knowing this, it's already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. Salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. It's time to wake up. Wake up. Wake up to spiritual realities. Christ is coming. He's nearer than when you first believed. Knowing the days are evil, it's time now to awaken from your slumber. Wake up from your spiritual sleep. Stop the apathy. Stop the lethargy. Snap out of your complacency, is essentially what Paul is saying. You see, he knows the human heart. He knows even as believers, sometimes we're complacent about spiritual matters. We start to coast in our Christian life. We don't live for the Lord as we should. We don't obey His word like we should. We're not living a trimmed back life like we should. We get comfortable. We crave comfort and ease. We don't live with an eternal perspective. We don't think about the fact that Christ could be returning at any moment. For us as believers, and so Paul says, wake up. Wake up. There's no time for this spiritual drowsiness. There's no time for this spiritual apathy. There's no time for this indifference. This is a call to vigilance. This is a call to snap out of it, to reject the absorption of the world and not be lulled into complacency. Notice what he goes on to say, verse 12. The night's almost gone. Or the summer's almost here. Or Jesus is almost arriving. The day is near. Therefore, what do you need to do? Lay aside the deeds of darkness. Put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy. You see what he's doing? He's saying Christ is coming. The night is almost gone. The day is near. Our salvation is closer than it's ever been to the arrival of Christ. So we need to behave properly. Put off your sin. Put off your carousing. Put off your spiritual compromise. Instead, verse 14, put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. You see what he's doing? Knowledge of the end informs how we live today. This is a call to spiritual vigilance. This is a call to spiritual alertness. Can I quote my favorite author, J.C. Ryle? He says, "Is it not true that we need a higher standard of personal holiness in this day? Where is our patience? Where is our zeal? Where is our love? Where are our works? Where is the power of religion to be seen as it was in times gone by? Where is that unmistakable tone that used to distinguish the saints of old and shake the world? Verily, our silver has become dross. Our wine mixed with water, our salt has very little savor. We are all more than half asleep." The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us awake and sleep no more. Let our eyes open more widely than we have done hitherto. Christian, can I ask you, are your eyes awake? Are your eyes open? Are you awake? Are you alert? Are you vigilant? Are you paying attention? Do you know that Christ is coming? Do you know that you could be in his presence at any moment? Do you realize what this means for your life today? Does it affect your choices? Does it affect your convictions? Does it affect your prayer life? The things you do with your money, the way you spend your time, the way you serve the Lord, does that have an impact in your life? Go back to Matthew 24. And as you do so, just listen to Ephesians 5:14. Jesus or Paul says, for this reason, it says, awake, sleeper, arise from the dead, and Christ will shine upon you. Paul picks it up in the same manner in Ephesians chapter 5. And the same thing in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. He says, let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. This is what Jesus is teaching. This is what Paul teaches. This is what you need to hear this morning. This is what I need to hear this morning. Are you alert? Are you sober? Are you awake? Are you attentive? Are you vigilant? I think we need to hear these things. Maybe this is the best New Year's sermon that could be preached. First Sunday in 2026. Are you alert? You all heard about the frog in the boiling water analogy. You put a frog in boiling water and you just slowly heat it up and has no idea that's happening. Is it possible we're frogs in boiling water? Temperature of the world is rising around us. Traction of the world, temptations of the world, love of the world. It's all slowly rising. Indifference to spiritual things. Indifference to the fact that Jesus could show up at any moment in the rapture. Indifferent to the fact that sin is offensive to a holy God. Indifferent to the fact that his word is truth. Indifferent to the fact that our culture suppresses all of these things and never encourages us to walk in these things. Are you discerning? Are you awake? Do you know that Christ is coming? He could be here at any moment. So the analogy Christ gives, the meaning Christ intends, this brings us to number three, the certainty Christ emphasizes. The certainty Christ emphasizes. Why do you need to be watchful? Why do you need to be attentive? Why do you need to be alert? Why do I need to be concerned about these things? Why does this matter? And that's the question that Jesus answers here for us in verses 34 and 35. Look what he says. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. If there is any inkling in your mind or heart this morning that perhaps these things will not take place as has been described in this chapter, if you're here this morning and you're wondering, you know, I don't know about all this stuff. I don't know about all this end time stuff. I don't know if it's actually going to go the way it's described here in Matthew 24. I'm not sure Jesus really is returning the way he says he is. If you have any doubt this morning, let me put those to bed. There is zero doubt that these things are going to happen the way they've been described. None. Because what you have here in verses 34 and 35 is a solemn pledge that it's going to take place exactly how Jesus said it would. There is no uncertainty here. There is no ambiguity here. There is no question here. Certainly, we can discuss various elements of the end times. There's different perspectives on how some of these things flesh out. Timing of the rapture, admittedly, there's differences there. There are some things that are hard for us to understand when it comes to some of these end times events. But the reality of them and the certainty of them is not in question. And so Jesus wants us to know this. That's why he starts verse 34 with a statement, "Truly I say to you." That's his way of saying everything that I've just told you and everything I'm telling you right now is absolute fact. Truly I say to you, I'm not lying to you. That is a statement of certainty. This is a promise. You can count on this. You can take this to the bank. This is absolutely certain truth. In fact, notice it. Just notice how these two verses read. "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." All these things will take place. It's guaranteed. And look at verse 35. "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." That's an amazing statement, verse 35. Heaven and earth are going to pass away, but my words will not pass away. If there is one thing constant in our universe, it is the fact that there is a sun and there's a solar system, and all the planets within that solar system revolve around that sun, and there is a universe that is consistent and constant, and all the laws of thermodynamics apply consistently. In fact, most of us never think about the fact that everything that we know in this world is one day going to come to an end. The heavens, the earth, everything that we look to for stability is one day going to be done away with. There will be a new heavens and a new earth. Revelation 21 and 22 describe it. It's predicted in Isaiah. There will be a new heavens and there will be a new earth. All of the things that we know in this life, heaven, earth, stars, sun, planets, all of that is going to one day be done away with, and there's going to be a recreation or a new creation, a renovation of the current system that we know as heaven and earth. There will be a new heavens and a new earth. All of that's going to pass away, but there is one thing that will not pass away, is Jesus' words. Jesus has told us these things are going to take place, and there should be no doubt in our minds, because his word is more dependable than anything. They're certain. So this is his point here as we come to the end of this parable. But before we close, if you will allow me, there is a technical issue that I just want to take a few moments to address here in verse 34, and it is an issue that you probably at least need to be aware of. And the question is, what is this generation? "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." That phrase, "this generation," there's a lot of ink spilled on which generation he's speaking of. So if you'll give me 5 minutes to give you some explanation of this, I think you'll find this helpful, and especially helpful because C.S. Lewis called this verse the most embarrassing verse in the Bible. From the mind of a skeptic, he says this is the most embarrassing verse in the Bible. And the reason he said that is because critics would look at this and say Jesus must have been mistaken here. Because if he's speaking to that generation, if he's speaking to those alive at his day, and he's saying all these things are going to happen, and when you see them happen, then I'm coming, and then that generation dies out, and none of this has happened, that makes Jesus look like a liar. Or at least confused or mistaken. Supposedly, Jesus expected the end within the lifetime of his contemporaries, which didn't happen. He thought he would be returning in glory during the lifetime of those people that were living at the time when he's speaking these words. That didn't happen, so Jesus clearly was mistaken. That is not the case. I promise you that is not the case. But you might have people come to you and say, look, and Jesus was mistaken. The Bible cannot be trusted. Jesus' words are not reliable because he said that all of these things were going to happen within the generation that was alive at his time. And so he's clearly mistaken, so the Bible's not trustworthy. How are you going to respond to that? Let me give you some ways that people have responded to this. Let me give you some various views on how to explain this generation in verse 34. Here's view number one, that it did relate to Jesus' contemporaries. But it was actually all fulfilled before that generation died. So view number one is that when Jesus spoke these words and says all of these things are going to take place and this generation will not pass away until all these things take place, he was speaking to that generation. He was speaking to that group of people alive in the first century, somewhere around 30 AD. Generation lasts 30 to 50 years. So within that generation, then all of these things were fulfilled. This is known as preterism. Preterism is the belief that most of these prophecies have already been fulfilled in the past. There are different degrees of preterism. There is mild preterism. There is moderate preterism. Then there is extreme preterism. Mild preterism believes that the tribulation was fulfilled within the first 300 years of Christianity. And moderate preterism believes that the tribulation and the bulk of this prophecy was fulfilled in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple and the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. The only thing that hasn't been fulfilled is the return of Christ. That's moderate preterism. And then there is extreme preterism, full preterism, which believes everything that was spoken in Matthew 24, including the second coming, has already occurred in the past. And to get that, they have to spiritualize these events. This cannot be true. Preterism cannot be true. Because the famines and earthquakes described in verse 7 have not taken place to the degree described here. Believers have not been hated by all nations, as described in verse 9. The false prophets and the false Christ, that didn't take place in 70 AD. The preaching of the gospel to the whole world is in verse 14. That didn't take place in 70 AD. The abomination of verse 15, that did not take place when Jerusalem was destroyed. The sun darkened, the moon darkened, the stars falling from the sky, described in verse 29, that did not take place when the Jerusalem city fell, and certainly Christ has not returned yet. So, I don't think there's any way that we can, in good conscience, adopt a preterist viewpoint. So, there has to be another view that is correct. The second view that is that this generation refers to the Jewish people. That is also it is a possibility that this is referring to the Jewish people. If that's the case, then in this view, Jesus is saying the Jewish people will not go out of existence until these things take place. The word generation here can refer to a race. In fact, I think if you look in your marginal note on verse 34, if you have one, it says race. It is possible that it is referring to a race of people. He might be saying the Jewish people will not pass away until all these things which he has been predicting have taken place. So in other words, he's promising that the Jewish people will continue as a people. I think that's true. I know for a fact the Jewish people, the Jewish race will be preserved in spite of terrible persecution until the Lord comes. I'm just not convinced that that's exactly what he's getting at in this passage. I have no doubt that the Jewish people will persevere until Christ returns. I'm just not convinced necessarily that that's exactly what he's trying to communicate here in verse 34. However, that is a possibility. So let me give you a third view. I think it's one of these last two views. The third view is that this generation refers not to a temporal reference, but to a qualitative reference, meaning it refers to a group of people with shared characteristics. And the shared characteristics that he has in mind when he says this generation is that the people of Israel viewed from their perspective of their rejection of their Messiah and the fact that they're a wicked and perverse generation. And so if that's the case, Jesus would essentially be saying, this wicked, faithless generation, race of Jewish people who've always been wicked, who've always been perverse. By the way, that's how the word is often used in Matthew, an evil and adulterous generation, an evil generation, an evil, unbelieving, perverted generation. He might be speaking here to the fact that he's referring to this evil, wicked generation of Jewish people will continue to be existence until Christ returns, changes their hearts, restores them to himself, and brings them to himself. That's a very good possibility, that he's referring to the fact that all of these things will still be in place. This wicked, perverse generation will continue to be in place until Jesus returns and replaces their heart of stone with a heart of flesh. I could go for that view. I could go for that view. I think that's a very strong possibility. The fourth view is this. The fourth view is that it refers to the generation of people that will be alive when all of these events take place. Future generation. Those living in the tribulation age. He's speaking ahead of time to that generation of people who will be living in the tribulation age when they're witnessing these signs, witnessing these things taking place, watching all of this take place, knowing that Christ is on his way. That is a very strong possibility as well. And that would fit with the parable of the fig tree, as he's just described. The budding of the fig tree points to the summer. The recognition of these signs points to the arrival of Christ, which is very soon to that generation. So it could be referring to that generation that is alive at the time when these signs are taking place. So I'll land on one of the last two views. How's that? I'm not going to land on the first two. I'm going to land on one of the last two. And if you pin me down more than that, I don't know what I'll do. It'll be one of those. Don't miss the point, though. Jesus is coming back. He could be here today to take you to be with himself in the rapture. And are you living like it? Are you living like it? Are you living with that in view? Are you living with that in your mind? Does it motivate your thoughts, your actions, your decisions? And I think really what's at stake here is what verses 34 and 35 say. Are you taking Christ at his word? Do you believe his word? Do you believe his promises? Do you believe with absolute undying conviction in your heart that these words are true? If you don't, you're not going to live the way you should. You're going to be doubting. You're going to be questioning. You're going to be quibbling over things in your own mind, in your heart, wrestling with whether these things are true or not. And you're not going to live the way that God has called you to live. You need to wrestle that down to the ground. You need to become convinced in your heart that Christ's words are true. And you live your life on the basis of those realities. See why this matters? We need to be alert, awake, vigilant, not drowsy, not sleepy, paying attention. So can I just ask you, is that where you're at today? Are you living that way? Are your spiritual antenna up? Is your spiritual radar up? Are you paying attention to what's going on in our world? And are you living with an eye to the fact that our Savior's coming? God, we thank you for these truths. Such helpful, profound, important truths for us to consider. Help us not to be spiritually apathetic. Help us not to be those who are drowsy. Help us not to be lulled into complacency by a life of comfort and ease. love for the passing pleasures of this world. Help us to be alert. Help us to live today knowing that our Savior could return at any moment. We ask that this will steal us with solid convictions, unshakable confidence in your words, so that our lives reflect a spiritual alertness for our good and for your glory. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a sermon by Pastor Todd Dykstra, teaching pastor of Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.